From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Thursday is the Baha'i's first day of Ridvan observance. Friday brings Hanuman Jayanti for Hindus and is also the start of the two-day Buddhist Theravadin New Year. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, another week, another state jumps aboard the hate train. Tennessee lawmakers sent the governor a bill that would permit mental health professionals to refuse to counsel certain people based on sincerely held principles. A North Carolina-style anti-transgender bill is next. A strange new story evolved from Pope invites Bernie Sanders to Vatican, to Vatican Conference on Poverty invites Sanders, to Sanders offered to attend Vatican Conference. Well, in any event, the presidential candidate is headed to Rome, even as the Pope headed to Greece to meet with refugees on the island of Lesbos. Speaker of the House Paul Ryan very unambiguously declared that he will not agree to be the GOP presidential nominee, even if drafted at this summer's convention. And then he released a short video that appeared to be a very well-made presidential campaign ad. Stay tuned on that one. And in an underreported development in the religious challenge to the Affordable Care Act's contraception mandate currently before the Supreme Court, the nonprofits, in essence, accepted a solution that differs little from the accommodation originally proposed by the Obama administration. Now, here's what else is coming up on State of Belief Radio.
My new game is Trump, the game.
Trump, the game where you deal for everything you ever wanted to own. Because it's not whether you win or lose, it's whether you win.
Yeah.
It's always gratifying to have journalist Jeff Charlotte weigh in on the most pressing issues of the day. That's why reading Jeff's recent New York Times Magazine article headlined Donald Trump, American Preacher, was both eye-opening and provocative. Jeff has been to several Trump rallies, and he's spoken to Trump fans about the fervor they feel for their candidate. And on this week's show, Jeff Charlotte will be back to share his analysis of what he saw and heard.
Liberal governors banning travel to the Tar Heel State, and businesses, basketball players, and rock stars boycotting.
In 2016, business interests have emerged as leading opponents to draconian pro-discrimination laws such as recently passed in North Carolina and Mississippi. Certainly, civil rights coalitions and progressive faith groups have been voices as well. But it was threatened boycotts that got the most credit when Georgia's governor recently vetoed that state's so-called religious freedom bill. And Indiana suffered a huge financial hit after yet another such law was passed there in 2015. For a look at both the impact of House Bill 2 in North Carolina on its LGBT citizens and the potential role for business interest in effecting change, I'll talk to Bob Page, a business owner and LGBT activist in Greensboro, North Carolina. But first,
in addition to the proposed integration of divorced and remarried people into the church, Amoris Laetitia offers very creative approaches to dating, domestic partnership, and parenting.
After a lengthy process that involved two global gatherings of Catholic bishops, much speculative news coverage, and not a small amount of factual debate, this month Pope Francis released his pastoral exhortation a book of church guidance on the subject of the family. For many, their reaction was based on expectations. While there can be no question that the document is a dramatic departure from the Pope's predecessor's legalistic and authoritarian focus, inviting a certain level of discretion on the part of Catholic leaders in different countries and cultures, it was still a disappointment for anyone expecting a significant change in the Church's position on hot-button issues such as divorce or homosexuality. Joining me right now, boy, I'm glad to say this, joining me right now to take a look at The Joy of Love is the Right Reverend Gene Robinson, retired Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire. Gene, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Welcome. It's always great to be with you. Thank you.
The last time you were with us, we were talking about your participation in the Pope's visit to the White House, and now we're talking about this much-anticipated publication. I don't know if you've ever expected to find yourself in this role of Francis analyst, but your unique role as a faith leader and advocate for change within your own denomination makes it really exciting to hear from you today. Do you think the Pope went as far as he could go with this pastoral exhortation?
Well, I think there are two questions here. One is the moral question, and one is the political question. So he may have gone as far as he thinks he can go politically at the moment, but I would just have to say that I'm disappointed with how much moral ground he covered in this latest statement. I think hopes were pretty high among several groups of people that, indeed, we might find the Roman Catholic Church moving in terms of doctrine on a number of fronts. Communion for those who have been divorced and remarried, certainly the LGBT community. And what we actually find is, once again, what this Pope has been very good at, which is changing the tone of things, but not changing the teaching or the doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I continue to believe that so far so good, but he hasn't gone very far.
Mm-hmm.
And because his tone is so positive, people are a little bit tricked into thinking he's gone further than he actually has.
So, Gene, what factors got in his way?
Here's the place that I'm incredibly sympathetic to him. The Vatican is not unlike Washington. Both of them have this enormous bureaucracy that was there before the Pope or the President arrived and will be there long after the Pope or the President leaves. And so he is trying to swim upstream against a bureaucracy that was largely appointed by his two predecessors, who were both very much more conservative than he is. This is a tough road. I think we don't yet know if he wants to change things. And number two, we don't know, even if he wants to change things, how much he will be able to change things.
Mm-hmm.
I think he may have to wait until he has actually appointed more bishops and cardinals. At the moment, he is not playing with his own team. He is playing with those appointed by his two predecessors.
Mm-hmm. Gene, I would think that most everybody understands the political dynamics around making a statement like this that is coming as an official statement rather than just a comment made on a plane or something like that. There's some people that I think are naive enough to think this all just comes out of a religious context and a religious motivation. It would be helpful if you'd talk for just a minute about what he's facing in light of what you have faced and other public religious figures face when we talk about our faith and values, but we have to do some of that conversation knowing that there are political consequences from it as well as religious consequences.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, not only is this Pope at the head of one of the major religions around the world, he's also a head of state, right? So politics is actually built right into his job description, whether he liked it or not. We'd love to think that the church, the synagogue, the mosque were all quite separate from the world of politics, but the fact of the matter is, if we're alive and moving around in the world, then we are affected by politics, and certainly the Pope is no different. I have to say I'm sympathetic to him because he is sitting at the head of a worldwide church. There are views that he might want to espouse for, let's say, Western European and North American Catholics that would no more work in Latin America or South America or Asia or Africa than fly to the moon. And so he almost has to go for the lowest common denominator that will not offend, not alienate, not completely go against the cultures of some places in the world. And so consequently, everyone winds up being a little bit disappointed, right? Those who would be from the more liberal United States, let's say, are disappointed that the Pope doesn't go far enough, and there would be those conservatives in other parts of the world which feels like, even in this statement, he has gone too far. He's gone too easy on those who have been divorced and remarried, or those who have had an abortion, something of that sort. So I'm really sympathetic to this incredible political bind that he is in, and that whatever he says has to somehow work worldwide in the vast range of cultures that the Roman Catholic Church finds itself in. The one place that, of course, I was really most disappointed in and really kind of mystified by, he says in this document, there are absolutely no grounds for considering homosexual unions to be in any way similar, remotely analogous to God's plan for marriage and family. I mean, I just find that astounding that he could make the claim that there is nothing remotely analogous to marriage in the relationships between two men or two women. And this is after he met with his former student and his former student's husband, this gay couple that he met with when he was here in Washington. And to come out with a statement that says, you know, really, there is just nothing remotely analogous to the relationship of marriage, I just thought was far more harsh than we might have heard. That was maybe the most disappointing thing in this entire document.
You know, I agree with you, and what strikes me is that the Pope may be really excelling in evaluating Roman Catholic theology and values and trying to make them more authentic. But that mistake, that omission, that confession of no way makes me think that the Pope really doesn't understand the dynamics of same-gender relationship and the passion for devotion and fidelity that exist in those relationships.
Yeah, I think that's right.
You know, I have the sense that when the Pope, this Pope, speaks, he thinks of what he would say as a human being, individually speaking, and he thinks about his role as the leader of the church and how he relates to its doctrine. And those may, in some ways, go in different directions.
Right, right. I think for any good clergy person of whatever faith, you're always trying to balance the personal and pastoral with the institutional.
Yeah.
And every one of us who is ordained has to find some kind of balance between those two.
Yeah.
It seems to me that for Christians, at least, Jesus always came down on the side of the personal and pastoral when it came to a choice between that and the institution.
Right.
Save his harshest criticism for those who were certainly trying to prop up the institution of religion. And so I have no doubt that this is an internal struggle for this Pope as well.
Gene, is this process going to continue? I mean, a lot went into the drafting of this pastoral exhortation on the family. Is there a chance for change in our lifetimes regarding LGBT people of faith and other Catholics affected by church teachings, or Is this pretty much it, do you think?
I think it will depend on how long this Pope lives. You know, I think if he is given the gift of a goodly number of years to be in this role, I think the potential for really great things is there for him. But it's going to take some time, and unless he lives long enough to make these kinds of changes, it's going to be very, very tough. This is a Pope that we have a chance of some change greater than we have had going all the way back to Pope John 23rd. So I still have great hopes for him and for the Roman Catholic Church. I think we just have to wait and see.
I think both of us would say, seriously, long live the Pope.
Yes, indeed.
The Right Reverend Gene Robinson is the retired Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire. Gene was the first openly gay person to be installed as a bishop, and his legacy includes fierce advocacy for inclusion of marginalized persons in the life and leadership of the church. Gene is the author of several important books, including God Believes in Love, Straight Talk About Gay Marriage. Today, Bishop Robinson is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. Gene, I thank you for being with us.
I always love being with you. Chatting with you feels like sitting down in the living room of your home and just having a family chat, and it's always great to come home to State of Belief.
Many of the headlines around various southern states' recent anti-gay legislation has focused on business opposition to such laws. For a unique look at this ongoing story, I'm joined by Bob Page, the founder and chair of Replacements Limited, based in Greensboro, North Carolina. Bob, I know that you have been very busy this week, and I want to say how much we appreciate you taking time to be on State of Belief Radio, and I welcome you to this conversation.
Well, I appreciate you having me on the show. Yes, I have been busy. We've had about 15,000 emails, phone calls, and letters.
My goodness.
I can't possibly answer all of them, but I have responded to thousands personally.
Well, I know you made a strong statement as a North Carolina-based business. I think our listeners would like to know what you said.
Basically, I just shared with people that I'm gay. I mean, many people already know that. I certainly haven't been in the closet for a long time. My partner and I, we have twin boys that will be 17 in July. We adopted them from Vietnam when they were 7.5 months old, and I was 55 at the time. And we also have in our household a young guy who's 16 years old from Nigeria that we found out through his brother, who played on the soccer team that our twin boys did, that he had this brother in Nigeria that really wanted to come to the States. So we sponsored him, and he's part of our family. I also shared that we have a number of transgender people here, which this HB2 law really affects them more than it does me, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And also, this is a recent development. I have a young man that will be living with us who is a 20-year-old student at UNCG and who happens to be a plaintiff in the lawsuit trying to overturn this, but he actually had a couple of summer jobs that when the information came out that he was a transgender man, that he lost both of those jobs.
Mm.
And he will be working here at Replacements this summer, you know, because his family does not support him. He will now actually will be living in our house. And these things are very personal to me because this little guy, just the neatest person, and he told me he made 1B in high school, a very motivated individual. These are real human beings that I feel like my life has been blessed to have them in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it pains me to see them being discriminated against. And I would like to say that there has never been an incident here in North Carolina of a transgender person attacking anyone in a restroom.
Mm-hmm.
And so this really was a problem that did not exist. And the little guy that lives with us now, he very much looks like a 12 to 14-year-old kid. He's actually 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But he is now required to use the women's room on campus by law, or he's breaking the law.
Mm.
And, you know, he told me that he continued to use the women's room until he was harassed and actually pushed and shoved. So he started using the men's room and has for years. And now he's required to use the women's room, which personally, I think is going to be a more of a problem than if he were in the men's room.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when he walks into a woman's restroom and they perceive that he is a man, that's going to be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very tiny individual. He's concerned about his own safety.
Mm-hmm. I think it's so important for us to hear what you're saying, because this is not a political ideology issue. It's a humanitarian issue.
Well, I do view it that way, too. And it's really about civil rights. And it especially is hard for me to understand when people of faith don't advocate for those who or, you know, being discriminated against. I think from my reading the Bible that Jesus would have been there for those people.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that the Bible says something about not judging others or casting the first stone. And of all those emails that I have gotten, there have been several who talked about suicide. A lady from Raleigh, where this is all spawning from, said that her good friend, who was a transgender female, committed suicide on her 21st birthday. And she told about what a beautiful individual this was, and somebody who actually, when she walked down the street, would give a dollar to every homeless person she walked by. And, you know, for people not to understand the worth of these people and not to care enough, it's troubling to me. You know, I have definitely learned a lot more. And one of the statistics is that transgender people, 40 to 45% of them attempt suicide at some point in their lives. And another lady who said her son moved to North Carolina just a few months ago, he was gay and committed suicide.
Mm.
I do think that the environment that is created by this type of hostility toward the LGBTQ community sets an environment. I just think about John Wesley, who said, do no harm, do good, stay in love with God. And when you are doing these things, you are harming other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here in North Carolina, there have been a real outpouring from the religious community that have sympathy for these. I mean, College Park Baptist Church here in Greensboro had a rally opposing the amendment. There were over 1,000 people there, standing room only. And there are many in the religious communities who are speaking out, but at the same time, Our Lady of Grace Catholic Church here in Greensboro, they headed up a rally and announced it in the bulletin supporting the governor and this law that discriminates against especially transgender people.
Bob, this is not the first time you've felt a duty to speak out on issues of discrimination. Does it feel at all like the positions people are taking this time are more supportive or more dismissive of the LGBT community?
Well, we were very vocal in opposition to Amendment 1, which ruled that marriage between a man and a woman. And at that time, I got far more people that responded negative than I have today. I would say the response has been 98% positive.
I see.
I mean, there have been some screamers, and one man who wanted to point out his credentials to me, that he's the retired CEO of a Fortune 500 company, and he is appalled that I would do this, but it's okay. You know, I knew people were going to oppose me. I knew we would lose some customers, but there are things that are just more important than money and business.
Did you start out as an openly gay business owner, or was there an evolution to that?
There was an evolution. I mean, you know, there are stages to coming out. I really came out publicly about 30 years ago. And, you know, I've had people who quit. One woman who went to work here, her husband was a police officer here in Greensboro, and he made her quit when he found out that it was a gay-owned business. Hmm. So we've endured discrimination for years. Someone spray-painted fags on the side of our building and you know, three-foot-tall letters, and we had to, you know, pay to have that removed. Someone destroyed our bathroom. We had to redo that in our showroom. And one time, a woman parked her car sideways, blocking the two-lane road coming into our business. And they had to have the sheriff physically remove her. And she was screaming about the homosexuals and the coming of the Lord. And so I know what it's like.
Sure.
I grew up in a rural community in North Carolina, and would not dream of letting anybody know what my thoughts were, and contemplated suicide myself. And thank God I got past that. And it's horrible what is happening to these people. They are human beings,
right?
Like we all are. And my feeling is that everybody needs to be loved and respected for who they are.
Bob, you live in North Carolina. You, as you said, you're married to a man. You're raising kids, nurturing a family. What is day-to-day life like where you live? And is there a contrast between day-to-day life and the ideology we see in House Bill 2?
Well, honestly, my day-to-day life would be much like any other family that has kids. You know, we get up, and sometimes it's a hassle to get the boys out of bed. We make sure they get ready and they're out the door on time, and they get to school. If I go to the gym that day, and then I come to work and interact with people here, do my thing, I go home. We have dinner together. Last night, my spouse had cooked barbecue chicken. And, I mean, if that's, you know, what a gay person's life like, it's really not dissimilar from most of the friends that I have. And most of my friends are straight.
Bob Page is founder and chair of Replacements Limited, the world's largest supplier of old and new dinnerware. His company is based in Greensboro, North Carolina. Bob, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. You have enlightened us, and I think you've inspired others to be exactly where you are in support of changing that horrendous piece of legislation. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed having the opportunity to speak with you.
What is it that keeps audiences rapt whenever Donald Trump speaks? Is it his years of television experience making him a genuine showman? Is it truly such a level of dissatisfaction with our failing nation that a man offering a way out is seen as a hero? Or could it be something else? Voting for that third option is investigative journalist and author Jeff Charlotte, whose article on the Trump phenomenon appeared in the New York Times Magazine under the headline, Donald Trump, American Preacher. And I am delighted that it brings Jeff Charlotte back to State of Belief Radio. Jeff, welcome back.
Hi, Wilton. Thanks for having me.
So I'd like for you to start by describing how much time you spent at Trump campaign events for this story.
I think last August I said to some magazine editors, I said, look, I think this is really going to go all the way. I think this is big. I think it's transformational. And we need to pay attention to it. And they're like, no, we're going to sign the story to funny writers. We're going to, we're going to do funny stuff. So here we are. And another editor said, would you go to a Trump rally? And this was so one Sunday. The next morning I had to get on a plane in 2 hours. So I had 2 hours notice and I hopped on a plane and flew to Youngstown, Ohio. And there began a sort of a month-long immersion in Trump land and rallies, mainly in Ohio and Arizona, but then reading through his books. And listeners might not know is there's also every Trump rally streamed online and then becomes part of this archive. And if you look at them, you see that tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, in some cases millions of people are watching these videos. It becomes like an entertainment. So when you go to a live rally, people stand around talking about, oh, did you see this rally here? Did you see this rally there? They're sort of like Grateful Dead fans who, want to tape every show. And so after sort of a month of that immersion, I came up for air and wrote this story.
Donald Trump, American Preacher. Now that's quite a headline. What did you observe that led to this kind of framing?
I didn't go in with a story in mind, but I did go in with a deep dissatisfaction, to be honest, with how my colleagues in the press were covering Trump, which was mainly through, even now, through either snark or this kind of very high-minded earnestness. Now, the snark is easy to dismiss. We know that that's not going to help us understand what's going on with something. It might help us laugh at it, and that might be healthy, but it's not going to help us understand. And the high-minded earnestness would be about the violence at the rallies. This is terrible. Well, it is terrible. But then the conclusions they drew that this is just anger. These people are just angry. They're just like George Wallace. And I'm like, well, first of all, it's not like George Wallace. George Wallace was a guy who part of his pitch was that, he was the son of a working man. Donald Trump's pitch is you don't vote for him despite the fact he's a billionaire. You vote for him because he's a billionaire. But more to the point, I thought, hey, where is this violence? And if you've reported the kinds of things that I've reported, violence is this heightened emotion, and it oftentimes goes hand in hand with ecstasy. It's also the performance of violence. When you watch the rallies online, Donald Trump, everyone gets very excited when someone's going to be expelled. So this seemed ritualistic. He coined a catchphrase, get him out of here. It seemed ritualistic, and it seemed the heightened emotion of violence was just a prelude to the kind of ecstasy. And so I thought there was going to be sort of a pseudo-religious element there. And at the first rally I attended, it was not subtle. It was overwhelming. And I was lucky because I didn't go as a member of the press. Donald Trump puts the press in a cage in the back and uses them as a prop in the sort of passion play in which he points to them and then everyone has to turn around and scream at them and mock them and flip them the bird and so on. And it means the press doesn't really have any sense of what's going on in the crowd. So I went as a member of the crowd, stood in line for 6 hours and got in and, swayed with them to the songs and moved along with the ritual with them, not saying things they didn't believe, but just sort of participating with them. And it became clear that for them, this was not about reason. It was about a kind of religion. But I don't mean that in the disparaging way that I think some liberals do. I think it's absolutely dangerous, but I don't mean it in that disparaging way.
Jeff, describe the audiences that you came into contact with.
Yeah, that was my first clue that this wasn't what people were saying what it was. I knew this was a caricature, but there's this caricature of the sort of the angry white men, these guys, these sort of like Duck Dynasty fans screaming and sputtering with rage. So I was stuck in line with a group of college students. Guy had been a Democrat all his life, two-time Obama voter, and now changed his registration in Pennsylvania, which takes some work, to become a Trump voter. And then a sort of a nice older middle-aged couple nearing retirement. Husband didn't talk a whole lot. the wife you would characterize as kind of a new agey, very pleasant. They were from Arizona. You might think she was from Sedona, that sort of new age capital. These were just not Trump voters. But then they would describe with relish the violence that they wanted to carry out on a protester. And it was sort of the joy of punching in their imagination. And this nice older woman would sort of tug me down and whisper in my ear incredibly lewd, crude things about Hillary whom she despised. And she had permission to say now. And I thought, this is something... There's something interesting. Now, the other thing that's important, I think, for people to reckon with, at least in Ohio, I met more Democrats than I met Republicans. And I think that's something that if we're thinking about the general election and worried about this from a progressive point of view, when I reported this, a lot of Democrats said, oh, that's not true. They're just pretending. I'm like, no, they weren't pretending. There's a lot of Democrats. There's a lot of people who would be Bernie voters if they thought he could win. I met people who thought that Trump was racist and didn't like that, but they were still going to vote for him. Because he's the only one talking about trade, and he's doing it with this promise of renewal.
A lot of Trump coverage focuses on angry crowds and an angry candidate. In your article, you describe something very different from that. Talk about that, if you would.
People at a Trump rally are having a good time. They know what he's going to say. They've watched it online. They're waiting for the lines. It's like waiting for the lyrics, you know, of your favorite song at a concert. The nature of it is that you go and you wait for about 5 hours, and you're packed in there, and there's the Trump playlist. He's got this sort of playlist of his favorite songs, sort of a surprising playlist, heavy on Elton John, Billy Joel, Rolling Stones, and Pavarotti. And people dance they sway to Elton John, and they bop up and down to Billy Joel, and they're a little confused by Pavarotti, but they think it's very special. They think it's kind of grand and classy, like Trump himself. And they tell each other tales of his wealth. They talk about the gold on his plane. They feel very, very happy. You wouldn't describe anger as a dominant emotion. You describe joy. I think there's an anger that is feeding into that joy. Those things are not so separate. But the happiness is something that is startling. And I don't mean to say that people shouldn't be worrying, oh, they're happy, that's okay. Because what Trump is doing is different than anyone else in American politics. This isn't politics who invoked violence before. And certainly there's a strain of redemption through violence, but there's never before been a politician who would go so close to the idea that you find your true self through the dream of violence, that violence is this liberation.
Jeff, you seem to be saying that policy matters are irrelevant in Trump's campaign. It's how he makes his audiences feel. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, that's the kind of thing that I think sort of liberals kind of want to dismiss. Well, that's not very serious. Well, most politics is about how you make people feel. Certainly, I voted for Obama, but go back to 2008. How many of you can sort of remember specific policy proposals? How many can remember the phrase hope and change? How many can remember the feeling of hope that they felt that Obama was able to channel, right? So what Trump does that's different is he doesn't really deal in hope. And when you think about it, hope is a constant in modern American politics. It's not just the politicians you like, it's also the politicians you don't like. They're doing hope, too. Ted Cruz is doing hope. George W. Bush is doing hope. Their hope might be for something different, but it's hope. Trump begins as this rally by employing the whole range of human emotion. It's not just this sort of emotions in a box. So short on policy, but long on emotional complexity, if not depth, right? The fact that, like a Quentin Tarantino movie, he's really going to explore envy. He's going to explore the idea of vengeance, long set pieces in describing what will be done to America's enemies. That is a tapping into this sort of emotional feeling. I talk to plenty of people who, in as much as he does have policies, and he does have more than I think the mainstream press is giving him credit for. They're more and more disturbing. But many people disagreed with those policies. It didn't matter. It was about emotional power. It was about emotional affect. It was about a politician who gave them license to feel everything that they feel, not just hope. Donald Trump says this is not a politics of hope, but also envy, anger, the grotesque, everything in us that makes us human, for better and oftentimes worse.
If Trump is a modern-day televangelist, what will it take for a dose of reality to penetrate with his supporters?
I would disagree with the question. What's the dose of reality? Look, I come from this from the perspective of, for all the anxiety about Trump, I don't think we're taking him nearly seriously enough. And I've reported on, you and I have talked about all the different corners of the right over the years, Wilton. This is bigger, more powerful, and has gotten further and wants to do more, this movement. It's dangerous, dangerous, dangerous. But I think when we put it in those arguments of the dose of reality, what's the dose of reality? I mean, I think about big part of his power, and I talk about him as a prosperity gospel preacher, using the sort of the promise of health and wealth, the law of faith, not the hope of reward, but the certainty. You put your faith in Donald Trump or God, Trump will take Trump, you will be rewarded. As he said, it's not 95%, it's 100%. That's not reality, right? But what is reality is what he's talking about, that the mainstream Democratic Party, certainly the Republican Party, but also the mainstream Democratic Party dropped. He talks, the biggest part of every talk is about trade. The biggest part of every talk is about attacking NAFTA, attacking the Trans-Pacific deal, talking about specific companies, the number of employees they fired as or let go as they moved abroad. That is a reality that he is speaking to, that certainly the Republican Party isn't speaking to, Bernie Sanders is speaking to, maybe Hillary Clinton is now too, but there's no way you can say that the Democratic Party historically has. He's also speaking to a reality of racial conflict. He's speaking to it from the side of let's stir it up, let's make it worse. But he's not crazy in saying, if you believe in a world like this, and a lot of his supporters do, if you believe in, so this, he's not going to call it white supremacy, but that's what it is, then you're in a conflict. He's not going to tell you we all think the same. He's not going to tell you that essentially, you know, he shares the ambitions of Black Lives Matter, because he knows you don't, as one of his followers, and he doesn't. That is the dose of very frightening reality that they already have. I think, to be honest, I think it's the rest of us who need to come to terms with the reality of Trumpism and start engaging with it, instead of this insisting that this is a small movement of disenfranchised or angry white men. It's a big movement. It may not win. And if it doesn't win, I'm afraid people are going to say, whew, well, no need to worry about that. No need to worry about the discovery that some 30% of America is ready to embrace fascism and is ready to act on it.
Okay, so I'm going to depend on your wisdom here. What happens in a contested election?
I'm very frightened of that. I think we all should be. I think you talk at Trump rallies, lots of people in Arizona. Arizona's an open carry state, so there would be guys walking around with, Glocks strapped to their thighs. And sort of dressed up in sort of their own homemade SWAT military costumes and so on. They were pretty open, a lot of these guys, about if they felt the nomination was stolen, they're going to do just what Trump said they were going to do. They're going to be in the streets. And I think if it is successfully stolen, and it would be stealing, I mean, that's the, it sort of consider like this, you know, you take all the sort of the militia types and so on and all their paranoid fantasies of government overreach, right? And look at the damage they can do based on these paranoid fantasies. Now comes this. If this nomination is taken away from them, it won't be a paranoid fantasy. It will be a fact. He will be the if they manage to give it to a Paul Ryan or John Kasich over the guy who ran and got the votes, they're not going to be paranoid. They're going to rightfully say this is a rigged system. And I think we would face, I fear that we would face a real serious uptick in domestic terrorism. So, but what's the alternative? Okay, well, we don't want that, so we better give it to Trump. Well, with Trump, we face something even worse. I don't think anyone is taking seriously how much Trump would not be bound by the rule of law if he were to win. People say, well, there's only so much the president can do. There's only so much the president can do if the president gives a damn about following the law. There's quite a bit they can do. So I don't think we have a real good solution. And I think the other thing for liberals to be thinking about and progressives to be thinking about is I see a lot of support in progressive circles for the idea of the Republican Party coming to its senses and somehow wrangling the nomination from Trump. And I understand how tempting that sensation is. But you know what? I do not think that the response to the most dangerous kind of authoritarian movement in recent U.S. history is to just throw democracy out the window. You set that precedent, that's going to, you know, those chickens are going to come home to roost. That is going to be a huge step away from whatever democracy we have. So I think it's big trouble to the left of us, big trouble to the right of us, big trouble straight ahead. I think there's no way to avoid this storm, and we'll have to see what's on the other side.
Jeff Charlotte is an investigative journalist and the author of several best-selling books with a focus on exposing the true driving forces behind the culture and politics. His latest book is Radiant Truths, Essential Dispatches, Reports, Confessions, and Other Essays on American Belief. Jeff is Associate Professor of Creative Writing at Dartmouth College. His insightful article, Donald Trump, American Preacher, appeared in the New York Times Magazine, and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Jeff, as always, thank you for what you teach us, and thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, thank you for what you do. It's a real great pleasure to be with you again. Thanks.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want you to know how sincerely I thank you. Your gifts are what keep this program on the air in large part. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with that person or those people. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes and in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. We would like for more people to pull up a chair and join this conversation. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long, online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the conversation. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.